Voilà, bonjour et bienvenue pour la troisième conférence du professeur Carr, toujours sur une approche de la Bible à partir des théories sur le traumatisme. On va rester aujourd'hui encore à l'époque de l'exil babylonien et il va nous présenter aujourd'hui, mais il vous le dira lui-même, deux figures du Pentateuque qui sont un peu représentatif d'une expérience de se trouver sans pays, sans terre. Voilà, David.
Merci, merci Thomas. Je commence avec un bref résumé de ma leçon. Je commence par deux définitions de Catholic Ruth sur le traumatisme. Le traumatisme est une terre indicible. Il est une histoire qui n'y a pas de place. Dans ma deuxième leçon, j'ai dit que la vie en exil n'est presque jamais décrite explicitement dans les traditions bibliques. Il y avait un blanc dans la narration biblique et la mémoire collective de l'exil. À la place d'un discours direct sur la vie en exil, il y avait une parole indirecte sur la souffrance de l'exil à travers d'autres figures, par exemple la fille de Sion, des personnes prophétiques eues en cours de souffrances souffrant dans le deuxième Ésaïe. Aujourd'hui, je parlerai d'un autre type de discours post-traumatique durant l'exil, un type encore plus important, le développement et l'accent mis sur la Torah. La Torah contient des histoires d'ancêtres, des figures comme Abraham, Sarah, Moïse et les Israélites. Ce sont des figures qui, dans l'ancienne tradition israélite, ne possédaient pas la terre d'Israël. Les exilés des Judées se voyaient dans ces figures. Ils ont développé des histoires sur ces figures dans la Torah hébraïque. La Torah était une forme d'ancienne mémoire d'écran pour les exilés qui ne pouvaient pas raconter leur histoire de façon plus directe. Maintenant, anglais. So, I start with this image. It's an image of a king from northern Syria, the town of Samal, which is now located on the southern border of Turkey. 2,700 years old, and he stands with his scribe in front of him. This kind of art was expensive, but this was a way that King Rakib wanted to portray himself to others. He wanted to show other people that he was the kind of king who had a scribe. And his was the kind of kingdom that had scribal texts. Kings like Bar-Rakib were lucky to even have just a few scribes writing such texts. For them, it was a way for them to claim the kind of prestige of much larger empires, such as Egypt or Babylonia, that had many scribes and thousands of texts. Bar-Rakib and his Davidic counterparts in Jerusalem imitated such bigger kingdoms in having scribes and texts. So they would write their own local versions of Egyptian or Babylonian scriptures. So where Egypt, for example, had the instruction of Amenhotep, an Israelite scribe copied and adapted that instruction into the book of Proverbs and attributed it to Solomon. Royal hymns were also important in these non-biblical ancient Near Eastern collections of Mesopotamia and Egypt. And local kings like David or Solomon had their own Hebrew royal hymns, some of which are still found in modified form in the book of Psalms in the Bible. And there were other types of literature too, common across the entire ancient Near East and often used in ancient scribal education. Royal histories. Love songs were a common part of such curricula, and we have counterparts to these in the Hebrew scriptures, as in, for example, the biblical book Song of Songs, present in a much later form, of course. This is what normal collections of scriptures looked like in the ancient Near East, whether Egypt, Babylonia, or the northern Mesopotamian Empire of Assyria. They were collections focused on the king, on wisdom, and ancient creation myths. So now to the question. The Old Testament, the Hebrew scriptures, which comes from that ancient Near East, has, as I've said, elements of what I just described in terms of a typical ancient Near Eastern scribal collection. But the Old Testament is profoundly different in its present form, in focus, from any other known ancient Near Eastern literature. It starts not with kings, but with landless ancestors, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses in the wilderness Israelites. And where other scriptures celebrate the founding of the capital city, such as, for example, Enuma Elish and the building of the Esagila Temple in Babylon, the Old Testament talks of Israel's origins in a barren wilderness. And finally, the greatest figure of the Old Testament, Hebrew Bible, Moses, is neither a king nor a priest, technically speaking, at least not primarily, but is really a super prophet in a class of his own. Let me pause here for Thomas to summarize.
Alors donc, Monsieur Carr a commencé à nous montrer quelles sont les productions littéraires normales liées à la royauté dans le Proche-Orient ancien. Il peut s'agir justement des textes sagesse, des textes poésie, des chants érotiques ou amoureux, et également des annales royaux qui célèbrent les hauts faits des rois. Tout cela, on le trouve aussi dans la Bible hébraïque. Mais ce qui fait la particularité du texte de la Bible hébraïque, c'est que dans le Pentateuque, en fait, on va commencer l'histoire non pas avec la fondation d'une capitale ou avec des exploits d'un roi, mais avec des patriarches qui ne possèdent pas le pays. Et ensuite, la figure de Moïse qui n'est ni une figure sacerdotale ni royale, mais qui est une sorte de prophète incomparable.
Merci beaucoup. The question I'm asking in this third presentation is, how did ancient Israel end up with such an unusual set of scriptures? One that starts with a Torah about Abraham, Moses, and other figures in Israel's history before it had a land. And my thesis, building on last week's lecture, is that a fundamental cause of the uniqueness of Israel's scriptures came from an event it almost never talks about. That is, the Babylonian destruction of Jerusalem and its temple, and then especially the exile of elite Judeans, particularly inhabitants of Jerusalem, to Babylon in the 6th century. I should mention, by the way, this is a visual image that helps you picture exile, but these images actually come from a relief by the Assyrian king Sennacherib and relate to a much earlier period. In any case, these Judeans were exiled in several waves: 596, before Jerusalem was destroyed, then again in 587, when Jerusalem was destroyed, and then another wave at apparently around 582. As I spoke last week, this forced exile to Babylon seems to have represented the deepest collective trauma for ancient Judah. It was a true near-death experience for the people. Not only had they lost their temple and their kingship, both quite important, of course, but they had lost their land. Toward the end of last week's lecture, I mentioned that this loss of land represented a disembodiment of the people. I suggested that much as a body is to an individual person, the land was to the people of Judah. Loss of their land meant that elite Judeans in Babylon, who believed themselves to be the core of the people of Judah, felt as if their people had lost their body. And this was the deepest trauma of Judah. And we can see the depth of this trauma in the fact that the biblical history, as we have it in the Hebrew Bible, says almost nothing directly about life in exile. The exceptions, as I mentioned last week, being Psalm 137 and the short note about Jehoiakim at the end of 2 Kings. This is also reflected, the level of trauma is reflected, in the growing focus in texts that we know to come from exile on figures who could represent the suffering of these Judean exiles that these exiles could not speak about directly. Figures, as I mentioned, like daughter Zion in the book of Lamentations, or the suffering servant seen in chapters 40 to 55 of the book of Isaiah.
Donc la thèse que professeur Carr va défendre, c'est que la spécificité justement de la littérature de la Bible hébraïque est liée à ce traumatisme de l'exil qui en effet va provoquer des écritures qui ne parlent pas directement de l'exil, mais qui en fait va trouver une autre origine pour le peuple. Il rappelle qu'il y a peu de textes dans la Bible qui font allusion directement à l'exil, à part le psaume 137 et la fin du livre des rois. Autrement, il y a des images qui peuvent être utilisées comme la fille de Sion dans les Lamentations ou encore le serviteur souffrant, mais il y a peu de textes vraiment qui mettent en scène ce que c'est l'exil.
Merci. So this is where we come to the part of the lecture where I focus on the Torah. For it is above all during the exile and the years following it that we see an increased focus in datable texts on Torah traditions, traditions from the Pentateuch. And I suggest that this is a way that the exile had an oblique and indirect impact on biblical literature. Exiles, Judean exiles, could not talk about their current landlessness and marginality directly. That's the gap. But they could talk about their more distant past, a past featuring traditions about landless patriarchs and Israelites wandering in the wilderness. They could speak of a time, in other words, before Israel had a land. That is the story world of the Pentateuch, of the Torah. It's a story of Israel before it had a land, and these stories became a way that Judeans in exile could rebuild their trust in the future. Now, this represented ancient Judah's equivalent to what Freud discussed under the heading of screen memory, memory d'écran. In an essay in 1899, Freud asked why victims of trauma retain some memories and not others. On the one hand, a patient of his might show no recall at all of the traumatic event itself, or not be able to speak of it. On the other hand, the same patient might remember another memory from the same time in their life in great detail and repeatedly talk about and mention it. Freud concluded that the detailed memories that the patient could remember served as screen memories for those trauma survivors. The screen memory had certain characteristics which protected this trauma survivor from a direct encounter with their traumatic memory. Now, shifting to later trauma scholarship, later studies have found similar screen memories, Nanette Arnhalb and Dori Laub's 1998 essay used Freud's category of screen memory to explain how some survivors of Nazi genocide avoided recall of the genocide itself or experiences in it, but talked in great detail of happy family life before the Shoah. Or a 1995 study by the scholar John Christian Knudsen examined how Vietnamese refugees avoided discussion of their present exiled status, but they preferred to talk of a more distant past, before they'd left their land, when they had jobs and status as doctors or government bureaucrats or whatnot, prestige and influence in their life before leaving their land.
Donc on peut guère parler de, du traumatisme qui fait qu'on est dans une situation de désarroi. Alors on va parler en fait des événements bien avant, mais qui sont d'une certaine manière comparables, ce qu'on peut observer dans la Torah, dans le Pentateuque. On va parler en effet des personnages marginaux et puis sans possession du pays, comme les patriarches, ce qui est une manière en effet de dépasser ce traumatisme. Ensuite, David Carr a fait allusion aux travaux de Freud sur ce qu'on peut appeler mémoire écran, où certains de ces patients traumatisés font totalement un blackout par rapport à ce qui arrive, en favorisant d'autres mémoires. Et des études plus récentes ont observé le même phénomène chez des survivants de la Shoah qui, en fait, parlaient plutôt de la vie de famille heureuse avant le génocide. Et un autre exemple, c'est les réfugiés, les boat people vietnamiens, qui eux aussi parlent beaucoup plus, en fait, de la situation avant la catastrophe.
So I wanted to stop for that summary because this concept of screen memory, I think, is a very interesting one to compare to what happens to collective memory among Judeans during the exile. And here is where I want to come to compare two quotes, one dated toward the beginning of the exile and the other dated toward the end. First of all, there's a text in Ezekiel 33, 24 to 29. He's a prophet who's placed at the very end of the pre-exilic period and beginning of the exilic period, and he is among the first of the wave of exiles in 596. This prophet in this text is depicted as rejecting those who back in the land who claim, quote, Abraham was only one person, and he took possession, vayarash, of the land. We are many, and the land is given to us as an inheritance. The prophet goes on to quote a Yahweh speech, then, that indicts the people for their misdeeds and swears to make the land desolate on their account. So Ezekiel is offering a very negative assessment of reliance on the ancestral promise. Apparently, a few decades later, Second Isaiah, that's Isaiah 40 to 55, opens one of his promises of the restoration of Zion with a divine call for the audience to, quote, look to Abraham your father and Sarah who birthed you. He, that is Abraham, was but one when I called him, and I blessed him and multiplied him. This, from 2 Isaiah, is a positive use of the ancestral promise to reinforce hope on the other side of several decades in exile. And this is but one example where promises that we find in 2 Isaiah, which is dated toward the end of the 50 years of forced exile, where 2 Isaiah draws on past traditions about ancestors, the Exodus, and wilderness to buttress promises of restoration for the exiles. If we are to take these distinctive texts in 2 Isaiah as a reflection of broader developments in the exile, that's something that's supported somewhat by ways the traditions are used in other likely exilic texts, such as laments. It would appear that stories about Israel's earliest history, that is, the ancestors, the wilderness, the Exodus, became increasingly important as a basis for hope amidst the Judean exiles in Babylon who doubted Yahweh's intent to resettle them in the land and restore them as a people. So we can see a movement from the beginning of the exile to the end, and that movement involves an increased focus on these figures. And we need to recognize here how important such a focus on hope would be to a people who has been traumatized by exile. Kai Erickson, an anthropologist who specialized in communal trauma, has said, quote, "One of the hardest earned and fragile accomplishments of childhood is basic trust. And this can be damaged beyond repair by trauma." End of quote. He worked with multiple traumatized communities in the U.S., and the people who had lost this basic trust had a lot of trouble restoring their trust and hope in the basic goodness of the world, to build an assumptive world in which they could live again. What the move that we see between those quotes from Ezekiel to 2 Isaiah shows is the increased focus in exilic prophecy on hope, particularly hope grounded in God's promises to the ancestors, to the patriarchs. In this way, it is not just the judgment of prophets or narratives that were meaningful to exiles, although they did help the exiles try to process their experience, but also the hope, the gradual rebuilding through textual scripture, particularly Torah stories, the gradual rebuilding of hope and faith in a coherent universe and a God who would take care of people who had lost everything. So on the one hand, the Judean exiles could relate to figures like Abraham or Sarah, who lived like them in a land not their own. More than earlier generations, the Judeans in exile saw themselves in Abraham, Jacob, Moses, and others who'd lived in foreign lands and were subject to foreign rule. On the other hand, these stories about Abraham and other figures were distinct enough from the exilic experience to be safe. They just thus served for these exiles as a collective form of screen memory. For Judean exiles, disinclined to speak directly about their present condition, caught in a collective amnesia about their exilic present and past, these Judeans in Babylon focused instead on stories of ancient ancestors. They looked to Abraham and Sarah, related to their struggles, and found hope in their promise.
Vous avez vu deux citations, un du livre d'Ézéchiel où il y a une référence à Abraham qui était seul qui a possédé le pays, et cette référence des personnes non exilées est très vivement critiquée par l'auteur de ce texte qui annonce plutôt la destruction, alors que quelques décennies plus tard, vous avez de nouveau une référence à Abraham qui, comme en Ézéchiel, est appelé seul, mais là avec Sarah, dans le deuxième Ésaïe, en Ésaïe 51, où Abraham et Sarah deviennent maintenant des figures d'identification possible vers lesquelles on peut regarder. Et donc on voit en fait une évolution par rapport à l'importance que vont jouer les patriarches, les matriarches, le thème aussi du désert, qui vont en effet être utilisés dans le deuxième Ésaïe et ailleurs pour construire en fait de nouveau une sorte de confiance de base, puisque un des phénomène qu'on peut observer chez des personnes ou des collectivités traumatisées, c'est cette perte d'une confiance de base dans la société, dans le monde dans lequel on vit. Et la fonction de ces textes sur les patriarches est notamment de reconstruire cette confiance de base et donner du coup l'espoir, l'espérance d'une restauration.
So, by now you have the basic idea. Let me get a bit more specific with two examples from Abraham and Moses. I start with the story of Abraham as we find it in the book of Genesis. And I want to look at how this story is told in a way that reflects the dynamics of the trauma of exile. Now, in doing so, let me be clear that I am not saying that the exiles invented Abraham or created stories about him only to comfort themselves. They were working with some traditions they already had of some kind, which we can't reconstruct. And as we can see from Ezekiel's prophecy, there were people talking about Abraham and Sarah and so on well before the time of exile, if in fact we can date that chapter to the early exile. But what I am saying here is that the stories we have in the book of Genesis have been reshaped to better address the dynamics of exile in Babylon and the needs of the Judean exiles at that time. Certain things were emphasized, certain details were added to make the exiles better able to relate to Abraham and find hope in his story, which they were focusing ever more on. So let me turn now to a few details in that story to get a better idea of what I mean. I start at the beginning, Abraham's call in Genesis 11 into 12. And the story starts in Mesopotamia, as we find it in the book of Genesis. The place that is named there is Ur of the Chaldeans. Ur is a Mesopotamian city, southern Mesopotamia. And the Chaldeans were the specific Neo-Babylonian empire that had exiled the Judeans. This is one of the first clues that we have that this story about Abraham, whatever its ancient origins, and I think there were ancient origins to it, was probably reshaped by Judeans now living among these 6th century Chaldeans in Mesopotamia. Such Chaldeans were not on the historical horizon in Abraham's time, but exiles writing tales about this newly important Abraham imagined him living a life like theirs among the Chaldeans. The story then goes on to describe God as giving this Mesopotamian Abraham a difficult command and a connected promise, which is quoted on the slide you see before you. He must leave his land, kindred, and house of his father, ancestral home, and in return, God says, I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great. And you will be a blessing, and I will bless those who bless you and curse anyone who even treats you lightly. And all the clans of the earth shall use you as an example of blessing in blessing themselves. I've expanded certain parts of the translation to make it clear. End of quote. Again, each part of this little three-verse command and promise is significant, and it rings with particular significance for the despairing Judean exiles. In this story, the Abraham those exiles can see is themselves. Like the exiled Judeans in Babylon, Abraham had to leave everything, land, kindred, ancestral home. Yet this ancestral Abraham gives those exiles hope. Where their nation had been destroyed, Abraham is promised future nationhood. Where they, exiles, may feel small, their ancestor Abraham is promised that his name will be great. This is, by the way, an appropriation of a specifically royal promise. Where they feel vulnerable, their father Abraham is offered special divine protection, where God will curse anyone who even treats him lightly, something often overlooked in translations. In all these ways, the exiles could find hope in Father Abraham that they too could receive such divine gifts. This promise is crucial. Hearing of it in the exilic version of the Abraham story would have helped exiles achieve what Kai Erickson said was a central task for traumatized communities, restoring hope and trust. This is why the Abraham story proved so important to later exiles. And we can see it, as I've said, in the way 2 Isaiah invokes the Abraham story in a new way that Ezekiel did not approve of. Abraham's story, and particularly the story of God's promises to Abraham, had become a touchstone for later exiles. Abraham in Ur of the Chaldeans was them. And they could take comfort in God's promises of fame, protection, and blessing to Abraham.
L'histoire ou les traditions d'Abraham n'ont pas été inventées seulement à l'époque de l'exil, mais ils ont joué un rôle très important à ce moment-là. Ils ont été retravaillés, édités, et notamment le début de l'histoire d'Abraham correspond très bien à une situation d'exilé. Abraham sort de Ur, Kasdim, de Ur des Chaldéens. Chaldéens, c'est un nom pour les néo-babyloniens, donc là on va tout de suite l'allusion au contexte historique précis. La grande vocation qu'il reçoit en 12, 1 à 3, qui lui permet la multiplication, donc une descendance nombreuse, la protection divine et la possession du pays, est en effet tout à fait clair pour des personnes qui se trouvent en exil, à qui ces textes-là redonnent la confiance, essaient à recréer la confiance perdue au moment de la destruction de Jérusalem.
So I could say much more about Abraham, but the limits of time and my wish to talk also about Moses mean that I'll move quickly to the end of the Abraham story for one more illustration of how the biblical Abraham story may have been reshaped to address the concerns of Judean exiles in Babylon. Here I'm thinking of this peculiar, striking story in Genesis 22, the Akedah, where God tells Abraham, quote, to take your son, your only one, the one whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him up as a burnt sacrifice on the mountain that I will show you. End of quote. The way the text emphasizes Abraham's relationship to Isaac helps emphasize that there is no doubt in the mind of the author that this command would be an awful thing for a parent to hearing. It was not at all normal for someone to be thought to be asked to do such a thing. And as if any parent needed any help in imagining how cruel such a divine command would be, the story stresses your son, your only one, the one whom you love. How could God command such a thing? After everything, if you know the story of Abraham, after everything Abraham has gone through, after all the promises have been laid upon this son, God is telling Abraham to sacrifice that son as a burnt offering. So just as Genesis 12 had been asking Abraham for him to leave his family of the past, to leave his ancestral home, in this text in Genesis 22, he's being asked to sacrifice his family of the future, the direction of hope. And as if to stress this irony, God's command to Abraham here, echoes the one that he was given at the outset. But there's one important difference. In the beginning, God had promised Abraham blessing and protection for leaving his family of the past. And God soon adds later in Genesis 12, 7, I'll give this land to your descendants. That's how the Abraham story started. But here in Genesis 22, God tells Abraham to sacrifice his one remaining descendant, your only son. He's already sent Ishmael away in Genesis 21. And no promise is given whatsoever at the beginning of this story. It is as if this story in Genesis 22 puts the entire promise that was given in Genesis 12 at risk. Perhaps more than any other story in Genesis, this one in Genesis 22 would have resonated with the exiles' deepest fears. God commanded their father Abraham, the proto-exile, to offer up his only son. Anyone who has experienced or studied the experience of exile can understand this fear. It is the fear among exiles about what will happen to their children in the new foreign land. I've seen this drama of first and second generation immigrants repeatedly among my children's classmates in New York, where I live. First generation exiles still have the former land and language and memory in their body. They themselves speak their mother tongue. They can sing their equivalent of the songs of Zion in that tongue. But what about their children? The second generation is not tied to the land they haven't known. And the native language does not come naturally to them. This is a challenge faced by exiles, ancient and modern, confronting the possibility that their child, their only one, their beloved, will be lost to them forever in the foreign land, either literally because of the dangers of vulnerable life in exile, or figuratively in their child being assimilated. And there's no more powerful way to evoke that challenge than through this story in Genesis 22, where Abraham was commanded by God to allow just this very thing to happen. The masterful storyteller of Genesis 22 does not tell us right away what will happen, but stretches the story out with Abraham saddling his donkey, bringing Isaac and his servants along on a 3-day trip, even talking with Isaac when Isaac is puzzled about the missing sacrificial animal, an incredible dialogue. And when Abraham and Isaac arrive at the spot that's been designated for the sacrifice, the story moves into agonizing slow motion, describing 6 separate actions, which are numbered on the slide, leading up to the very point of Isaac's potential death. Abraham builds an altar, arranges wood on it, ties Isaac up, places him on the altar on top of the wood to burn him, draws out his hand, takes the knife to sacrifice his son. And only at this very last point in the story does a messenger of Yahweh call from heaven and stay his hand. Don't, quote, "Don't send your hand to the boy and don't do anything to him, because I know that you fear God and would not withhold your son, your only one, from me." And only then does Abraham look up and see the animal he had trusted that God would provide, a ram caught in a thicket. And then he can offer the ram as a burnt offering on the altar he had built. And he receives then a reaffirmation of God's promise that had been missing from the initial command in Genesis 22:2. "Because Abraham would not withhold your son, your only one, God will bless Abraham and multiply his offspring. And once again, all the nations of the earth will bless themselves by you because you obeyed my voice." End of quote. So, if Abraham, the character Abraham, ever doubted God would follow through on God's promises, and it is in doubt, if the exiles, the Judean exiles, doubted this too, had their own questions about God's promises, their own questions as they tried to rebuild hope, they receive their reassurance here in this text. The text stresses, in contrast to the promise we saw in Genesis 12, that Abraham's obedience at Moriah ensured God's promises both for him and for subsequent generations, his seed. Because Abraham was obedient, because he, quote, "listened to God's voice," both he and his descendants, including the exiles in Babylon, could trust that God would multiply and bless them. Having left their homeland, the exiles understood all too well the possibility that they might lose their children, literally or figuratively. Yet Genesis here tells of how Abraham faced and overcame such a challenge. And in the process, Abraham ensured that God would bless and protect every future generation of heirs of Abraham, including the exiles in Babylon.
Genèse 22, l'histoire dite du sacrifice d'Isaac ou l'Akeda, fait un peu écho à Genèse 12, puisque dans les deux cas, Dieu donne un ordre à Abraham, Abraham suit l'ordre. La différence de Genèse 22, c'est que maintenant, ce qui est en question là, c'est l'avenir, c'est-à-dire la descendance d'Abraham, puisque Abraham est donc demandé par Dieu, demande à Abraham de sacrifier son fils. Ce qui, dans un contexte exilique, en effet, peut refléter la peur de l'avenir à un niveau plus général, mais de manière aussi plus concrète, la peur de perdre en fait le lien avec la deuxième génération. Donc M. K a rappelé souvent que la deuxième génération des gens exilés, émigrés, vivant en diaspora, vont perdre le repère, le lien avec le pays, vont perdre la langue. Et donc ce qui se reflète derrière cet ordre, c'est aussi cette peur-là. Et une des fonctions de Genèse 22 est justement de montrer que la confiance que Abraham a montrée par rapport à cet ordre assez incompréhensible lui permettra justement d'avoir une réassurance par rapport au fait que l'histoire va commencer, va continuer aussi avec la deuxième génération et les générations futures.
So, I want to give you at least one more example of how the Torah story was shaped by exilic trauma. And here I will focus on the story of Moses, which covers the books of Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy in the Old Testament. Now, of course, I can't cover the whole story, and in particular, I won't be discussing the law of the Torah, which would be an obvious place to focus a discussion on trauma in the Bible, but I have to decide where to focus. So that would have to be a subject of another lecture. Instead, what I want to highlight here are a few things that suggest that the narratives about Moses, like the narratives about Abraham, were reshaped during the Babylonian exile in order to better reflect and speak to the exiles' experience, to minister to them and subsequent generations. In this way, the figure of Moses, like the figure of Abraham, like the daughter of Zion, like the suffering servant, were figures that could embody the experience of Judean exiles that they couldn't speak directly of. It could be a form of screen memory. So let me move first of all to imagine how the first part of the story of Moses would have sounded to people in Babylonian exile facing the vulnerability of life in a foreign country. Moses is born amidst a situation born amidst a situation where the people are living in Egypt, and an Egyptian king is trying to kill all their male children. Moses' mother later exposes him to possible death, putting him in a basket on the Nile River, sending him as a baby away until he's rescued by chance by a princess in Pharaoh's court. He eventually grows up, protected in the Egyptian household. But as soon as he grows up, he murders an Egyptian beating an Israelite and has to flee from Pharaoh's wrath out of Egypt. He goes into the wilderness, and it is there, while Moses is living abroad, that he marries and receives God's commission at a holy mountain to free God's people, a mountain named Horeb, but implicitly Sinai as well. And then, just having received his commission from God, one of the strangest stories of the Bible describes that very same God who just commissioned him, attacking him and attempting to kill him in Exodus 4, verse 24. Moses is only saved when his wife, Zipporah, circumcises their son and marks Moses' feet with the bloody foreskin. This is the early story of Moses' life, showing him living as a foreigner in Egypt and then Midian, and repeatedly exposed to danger. As we go on with the story, once he comes home, it's not a simple process getting his people out of Egypt either. One might think that the book of Exodus would then directly narrate how Moses led his people out of Egypt, just as God had told him. But as in the story of Abraham and Isaac, the story of Exodus out of Egypt is stretched out. Pharaoh initially says no to the Israelites leaving Egypt. And even when Pharaoh eventually, after several plagues, starts to say yes, God hardens Pharaoh's heart, and the Israelites have to stay in Egypt a bit longer. Then the rest of the book of Exodus narrates a constantly delayed exodus out of Egypt with multiple plagues as God repeatedly hardens the heart of Pharaoh. This is a story of a delayed exodus that's not paralleled by many other biblical traditions, a story of delay that I and many other scholars think was introduced into the Exodus tradition by exilic or post-exilic storytellers. This story of God's liberation of Israel out of Egypt after a delay would have spoken to the exiles' struggles with disappointed expectations. We know that there were prophets in Jeremiah's and other times that predicted a brief exile, something that it turned out was not true. The book of Exodus, the story of Exodus as we have it now, tells, by way of a story of delayed liberation from Egypt, of how God could work in indirect and extended ways to free God's people, even as God ultimately wins God's people in a grand fashion. In other words, this story of delayed Exodus could help the exiles understand why the exile was taking so long. Finally, turning more toward the end of the Moses story, I'm not giving anything away to suggest that the rest of the story of Moses also shows many difficulties. The metaphor, indeed, of the barren and dangerous wilderness served as a powerful image to the Judean exiles of their own experience of social chaos. And just as the exiles faced the peril of possible extinction as a people in Babylon, so also the story of Moses and the Israelites describes several places where God almost destroys the whole Israelite people in the wilderness. First with the golden calf, and then later in the spy story. They're right at the edge of near death and are barely saved through the petitions of Moses. The whole story of Israel in the wilderness, indeed, is a story of decades of conflict with God, one that mirrors the decades that the Judeans spent in Babylon. And just as most Judeans who went into exile ended up dying in Babylon, because life expectancy at that time was no more than 30 or 40 years, and the exile lasted at least 50. So also, the Moses story describes how almost all of the generation that left Egypt ended up dying in the wilderness. And here again, Moses' individual life mirrors the life of his people, since he too dies before entering the promised land. So the Torah, Pentateuch, ends with an account of Moses' death and burial within sight of the land he'd been commissioned to lead his people to. Moses never enters the promised land, but the children of the Exodus generation do enter. And in this way, the biblical story of Moses expresses the hope of exiles that their children, at least, might experience a return home that most exiles would never experience personally.
Après Abraham, l'histoire de Moïse peut aussi être utilisée dans ce contexte pour expliquer comment en fait on essaie de donner du sens dans une expérience traumatisante. On aura pu parler aussi de la loi qui jouera certainement aussi un rôle important, mais là, M. Carr s'est concentré sur l'histoire de Moïse qui lui-même, puisqu'il a tué un Égyptien, doit déjà faire l'expérience de l'exil et se trouve dans le désert où il va avoir sa vocation, mais aussitôt cette vocation est mise en question par le fait que Yahvé lui-même vient pour l'attaquer, et c'est seulement sa femme qui va le sauver de cela. Ensuite, dans une deuxième partie, l'histoire des plaies montre en fait une sorte de retardement de l'exode, à savoir que l'exil continue à durer, ce qui est aussi une manière d'avoir un autre discours par rapport à des attentes comme quoi l'exil sera très court. Donc les histoires des plaies, selon David Carr, ont été introduites à l'époque exilique ou post-exilique pour montrer que l'exil peut durer, mais néanmoins il y a un retour possible. Ce retour, ensuite, dans l'histoire du désert, dans le livre de l'Exode et du Nombre, va cependant pas concerner la première génération qui va en effet mourir dans le désert, c'est-à-dire en exil, comme Moïse lui-même qui meurt sans pouvoir entrer ou rentrer dans le pays. Par contre, la deuxième génération a cette possibilité. Donc il y a, malgré les évidences, cet espoir que l'exil ne va pas durer pour toujours, mais qu'une génération future pourrait en effet retrouver le pays.
So I come to my last major section of my talk today. Building on Freud's work, some work by another trauma theorist, Kathy Carruth, suggests that one important component of survival for many traumatized individuals is the development of a belief by trauma survivors that they were chosen to survive. They didn't just survive randomly. God had preserved their life for a reason, for a purpose. For example, one of my students who worked in a burn unit at a hospital spoke of how the survivors who she worked with often understood themselves as having survived horrible injuries so that their life could serve some broader purpose. They might have lived while the other person in their hospital room did not, and they tried to understand how that could have happened. In this way, people confronted the apparent chaos of their near brush with death and claimed a mission that it could explain and ground their future. The trauma survivors who actually survived were chosen. They understood themselves to be chosen to make a difference, and that was why they survived. So also, it appears that the Judeans, especially in the exile and afterward, focused ever more on God's choosing of them, separating them out from other nations. We see this concretely both in the development of stories in the Pentateuch about God's choosing of the people and in stories about those who returned from exile in Ezra and Nehemiah, defining themselves as a separate people. This idea of choosing or election comes to have more importance than the celebration, for example, of Jerusalem Zion, which is so prominent in the late pre-exile and still important in the late exilic prophecy of 2 Isaiah. Why is this so? I would suggest election theology, the idea of the chosenness of the people, had more long-term influence for diaspora communities, for communities in exile, because that idea of chosenness was attached to a people and not a place like Jerusalem. So Zion theology, although it had probably been more prominent in an earlier period, became limited as a guiding metaphor because it was attached to the Jerusalem or Zion that had been destroyed. So this is a time when Judeans start seeing themselves through the lens of Israel. And this is one crucial aspect of the story that is not precisely parallel to their situation, and that is, who are the major people featured in the story? And here we have to remember something I emphasized in my first lecture, which is the idea that Judah, in an earlier period, was not identical with Israel to the north. They were really somewhat distinct peoples. But Israel to the north had been wiped out, at least as a nation, by the Assyrians in the 8th century. It's during the late pre-exile, and especially the exile, that we see an increasing focus by Judeans on claiming and expanding on the history of Israel. So, I would suggest this reflects the profundity of the struggle of Judean exiles to deal with the inexplicable fact of their survival. After all, when they went into exile, they had no certainty that their faith would diverge from that of the northern kingdom of Israel that had been destroyed by Assyria. Assyria did almost exactly the same things to northern Israel that Babylon later did with Jerusalem and Judah. And indeed, many of the prophetic traditions we now have in the Bible, from Amos up to and including Jeremiah and Ezekiel, repeatedly draw parallels between the fate of the north in Israel, which was destroyed by the Assyrians, and the south in Judah. What was to say that Judeans would survive when the Israel of the north had not? I'm suggesting that the exilic choice to adopt Israel's identity reflects the kind of ambivalence seen sometimes among siblings when an older child dies in a family and a younger one is implicitly charged with living out the destiny of the child who died. Or I'm reminded of a story by one of my students at a program at Columbia University that I teach in. This student described how her life was forever shaped by the fact that she was born as one of two twins, but she was the only one of the twins who survived. And throughout her whole life, she felt the burden of trying to prove through what she did why her life was worth being the one that was preserved. That's the challenge of survival. Judah survived Babylonian exile, and like a younger sibling living out the destiny of an older one who died early, the people of Judah came to take on the name and destiny of Israel and to take over Israel's Torah story, taking over the story of their sibling who didn't make it.
Alors, une autre manière de dépasser le traumatisme, surtout lorsqu'on échappe dans une catastrophe ou d'autres en péril, c'est l'idée qu'on a été élu justement pour être sauvé. Donc c'est l'idée de l'élection qui va jouer un rôle important dans ce discours. On constate que dans le discours traditionnel sur l'élection, c'est le mont Sion qui est élu, maintenant c'est le peuple qui va être élu. Et cette élection aussi s'accompagne dans beaucoup de textes par une identification en fait des Judéens qui étaient exilés à Babylone avec Israël. Donc en fait l'identification Juda-Israël est selon David Carr une manière aussi de dépasser le traumatisme. Israël avait le même destin, mais maintenant on s'identifie avec Israël et on va montrer qu'on n'a pas forcément le même destin. C'est quelque chose qu'on peut observer aussi au niveau des frères et des sœurs, dont un meurt, et puis le survivant va s'identifier en fait avec la personne morte et essayer en fait de montrer qu'elle a tout à fait, ou il ou elle a tout à fait mérité de pouvoir survivre, bien que ce n'est pas toujours très facile.
Merci beaucoup. So, the more one reads the Torah in this light, I would suggest, the more we see links between the Judean exile in Babylon and exilic trauma and these stories. It is how the world depicted in the Torah mirrors the drama of self-doubt, terrifying violence, and tenuous survival of a people who experienced exile and eventually was not destroyed. As I've said a number of times now, they couldn't speak of their own experience directly, but through adopting ancient traditions and shaping them into this Torah that we have now, they could speak indirectly of their experience and find hope. So this included an exilically reshaped Abraham story with stories of promise of blessing and threat to his offspring. It included an exilically reshaped story of Moses and an exilically reshaped set of laws, where Moses as an individual mirrors his own people's experience of threat of destruction and encounter with God. And it includes overall a Torah story of a landless Israel chosen to follow the law that will, at least in the form of their children, survive. This post-traumatic focus on Torah, on landless ancestors, is a story for people who couldn't talk directly of exile. They couldn't talk directly of life in Tel Aviv or the city of Judah in Babylon. So Egypt, not Babylon, is the major foreign power in this story, and Israel, not Judah, are the primary participants. Yet through stories of ancestors in Exodus, the Judean exiles could come to claim their identity as Israelites and depict their world and journey through it. They could find a God who knew them and cared for them and would help them survive. They could find voice. They could find hope. Thank you for your attention.